it's all about the ABCs. It's accuracy, brevity, and clarity. What you write has to be accurate, and that applies to anyone, but especially advocates, because credibility is our currency with the court. If you're not credible, you're not going to get anything. But once you have something accurate, you've got to make it as brief as you can, because if you have to keep the judges or the public's attention to actually get the impact that you want. And as you're working to whittle down, you have to make sure that you're maintaining clarity as well.
Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. Now let's get started.
Hello and welcome back. In today's episode, I speak with my friend and former co-clerk, Jared Nicely, who's a senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, here in Washington. In Jared's practice, he focuses on defending imperiled species, protecting communities from chemical spills, ensuring public access to government records, and enforcing federal and state environmental laws. Jared joined NRDC as a Beagle Litigation Fellow 7 years ago after clerking for Judge Diana Gribben Motz, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit in Baltimore, and former podcast guest and my former boss, Judge Ellen Siegel-Hevel, on the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. Jared's a graduate of the University of Virginia, where he studied urban planning, go Wahoos, and holds a law degree from Harvard, where he served as editor-in-chief of the Harvard Environmental Law Review. Go Crimson. On a personal note, Jared's a super nice guy, one of the smartest, sharpest, clearest writers I've ever worked with, and I'm so excited I convinced him to come on the podcast. So welcome to the podcast, Jared.
Thanks for having me, Jonah.
Awesome. So I want to start by talking about your work at NRDC. So before we jump into how you became an environmental lawyer, I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about what you do every day, what kind of tasks you're involved in, what your practice looks like.
Sure. So I'm on NRDC's litigation team, which means that I focus almost exclusively on litigation-related work, whether that's developing cases for us to bring affirmatively as plaintiffs on behalf of community partners, whether it's actively litigating cases, whether it's evaluating currently ongoing rulemaking processes to determine whether we may have a case in the future. And it even extends to sometimes defending government actions or other parties that we think could use help in litigation. But basically every part of my job somehow touches on either preparing for litigating, actively litigating, or in many cases also implementing remedies that we've won.
And I love that concept of preparing for litigation, finding community partners. Can you talk a little bit about what that sort of actually looks like? Do you see something in the newspaper one day and say, let's go find a plaintiff? Are you connected with organizations in the community?
There are two categories of cases in the environmental world, somewhat overlapping, but reactive and proactive. Most of our cases were reactive, reacting to bad things that were coming out of the federal government and challenging those actions. Many of those cases born out of necessity, but they come from, for me, the litigator, they come from my program colleagues who are subject matter experts in the issue at hand in the regulation that's come out, for instance, or they come from partners that we have that care deeply about the issues and see the on-the-ground impacts of the government regulation or deregulation of the issue, and they bring it to us and we evaluate it and bring suit. There's also a proactive category where there's a direction that we think the law should be going. These, again, can come from ideas from our program subject matter expert colleagues that they bring it to us, or they can come from community partners who have a particular problem and we work through what the best solution might be. And we try to achieve that through litigation as one of the means of change. And the middle ground of that are environmental enforcement cases against polluters, which you can categorize that as reactive because there's pollution going on and we're reacting to it. But I think it's proactive as well because it does require a substantial dedication of resources, both from the people on the ground that are experiencing the externalities of pollution, and then an organization like NRDC that would be litigating the case to actually bring it, often against a defendant that's represented by a big law firm. And those cases, you know, tend to come, or some of those cases come directly to us from community partners on the ground that have heard about our reputation and our experience in other cases and would like us to take theirs on, or at least consider taking theirs on. I think historically, to the discredit of the environmental movement, our model has been to identify a problem and then to identify plaintiffs later. And that often leads to backward solutions for the people who need help the most. More recently, we've been working to develop longstanding and real relationships with community partners on the ground, as well as national kind of umbrella groups for environmental justice organizations, for instance, that can bring problems to us so that we know that the problems that we're interested in and thinking about litigating are actual problems that they care about, and that we can align early on in the process about what the right solutions might be. But there are also circumstances where people come to us. The one example, and the Safe Drinking Water Act lawsuit that I helped litigate with several of my colleagues alongside the ACLU of Michigan and Flint, we were actually approached by the ACLU because of our expertise in bringing environmental enforcement action. So this was at a time right before the Flint water crisis blew up in the national media, but it was something that was brought to us because of the type of work that we do and our reputation in the field.
And in terms of the legal work, obviously you have to be a subject matter expert, and you become a subject matter expert, I would imagine, by just doing a lot of cases about the same topics over and over again, both individually and as an organization. But in terms of the actual legal work, what are some of your favorite parts of the litigation process? And what are the parts that are a little bit of a slog, but are really necessary to keep the case going?
I think my favorite part of every litigation process is filing the complaint, because in most cases, we have time to really think about how we're going to frame this. And it's when you decide how you're going to tell your story and present it. And complaints are, in many cases, not actually that important to how the case ultimately ends up, as long as you have your short and plain statement of the facts necessary to substantiate the relief you're requesting. You've complied with the federal rules, but it's a press release for the judge, for your clients, for the press and the media and the world at large about what's happened and why we should win, why we've been aggrieved and have a remedy. So I really love that part of the case. And beyond that, on the litigation team, because our expertise is litigation, we actually don't develop those really deep expertise in particular subject matter areas. As you would expect, we're oftentimes, in leading up to a complaint or a petition for review, we're developing that expertise in the moment, in a crunch of time. And that's just really exciting, because every case brings new issues that we haven't necessarily dealt with and new considerations. And we're lucky at NRDC, we have many subject matter experts who are also attorneys, but also scientists and policy wonks that do have that deep expertise on the issues at hand, whether it's a wildlife issue or a toxics issue or a clean air issue that we can draw from. But the expertise that we bring to each case is, how do we translate that political, that scientific, that technical expertise into something that a judge will understand and that can get us closer to the relief we're seeking?
That's awesome. I actually also really liked, in private practice, writing complaints. I think that is a piece, I don't know about your experience at Harvard, my experience at Georgetown, I got through my whole 3 years of law school and never even read a complaint, better yet, wrote a complaint. And it's its own sort of beast. And I love how you talk about it as more than just the short, plain statement that the rules require. That's part of it. How do you think about writing a complaint? So you get this new case, you're thinking about all the strategic pieces. How do you write a complaint that sort of serves all these different audiences?
I start as even the opposite of when I'm writing a summary judgment brief, but with the complaints, I really start with the facts as I know them. What are the key facts and what are the facts I'm building around? And then start moving them around in a way to tell the most effective story that I can. And that's a story that both shows the wrongdoing clearly, and then more importantly, explains why it matters and who it matters to and who's benefiting from it. And I think that's the goal with every complaint. You don't always have enough time to really make that happen effectively. But if you lead with the facts first, and you can tell that compelling story, everything else will fall into place in terms of themes and framing for the rest of the lawsuit.
And are there things about environmental cases that sort of make the life of a litigator a little bit different? Are there particular parts that are particularly complicated, particularly not so complicated, that sort of make environmental litigation different than general civil litigation or even criminal litigation?
I think you have to have a comfort ultimately with science and numbers. It doesn't mean you have to understand it very well going into any particular suit, but you have to be willing to, and you are I think more than the average civil litigator, but there are certainly other fields of civil litigation where this is definitely the case too. You're a translator. You are, just as in the complaint, we're talking about translating a broader story into themes of right and wrong and justice and injustice. When you're in the meat and potatoes of a brief, you're translating complicated scientific concepts and ideas, often in contexts where the agency is going to get substantial deference from the court, into simple, understandable concepts that the court will be able to grasp quickly, understanding their limited time, and understand what your point is and why the agency in particular went off.
And in terms of agency deference, that's something that I think lawyers who have spent time like we did clerking or have spent more time in the law generally have a good sense of. But maybe for people who are a little less familiar, can you talk a little bit about what it's like to litigate where the deference is with your opponent? The best analogy I can think of is it's probably like starting a baseball game where the other team already has four runs, but I'd be curious how you think about that.
I think that's a good analogy. Courts are obligated under the Administrative Procedure Act and longstanding Supreme Court precedent to take a hard look at what agencies do and the reasons that they give for their decisions. But the case law is also clear that agencies are, when they're working within the realm of their subject matter expertise, have a lot of discretion in making policy decisions. And it really does require us to focus in on technical arguments and focusing on how the agency has missed things or disregarded relevant information, more so than just saying that the agency made the wrong policy decision or the agency didn't evaluate the evidence the way we would have liked them to, because those are losing arguments 99 times out of 100. But you have to have an incredible attention to detail. And it really helps to have on your team someone working with you that is in the weeds on the scientific issues that can really help you tease out where an argument that you'd like to make or you think that may be there is actually an argument that falls in the camp of policy decision making, which the agency is going to get deference on more than likely, or if it's actually the agency missed something or didn't address an important part of the problem that you can point to and potentially win with.
And it strikes me also that telling that story in the complaint is even more important when the sort of runs are already against you, to keep the judge's mind open and the public's mind open and even the agency's mind open to maybe we missed something.
Exactly. And there's a part of the complaint too that, and it flows through the rest of the case where a lot of your arguments are going to be very in the weeds or technical about things that the agency missed, but you have to be able to tell that story in a way that ties it together with a higher level theme of an agency that's ignoring bad facts because it does want to reach a certain outcome, or an agency that you don't even have to attribute malice. It can just be that they miss something. And that happens sometimes, but the agency's obligation is to consider everything that's before them. But that's one of the reasons that writing a complaint is so important, and I enjoy it, is because it is the time when you start trying to tie those pieces together and really understand what your case is about, not as a on-the-ground matter, but as a persuasive and rhetorical piece of writing.
And do you think having built that theme in the complaint, it's easier to then come back to that theme for the years and years that might follow of litigation?
Absolutely. And obviously the themes can change, particularly in cases if we're not litigating against an agency, but are bringing an enforcement action, for instance, against a polluter. The theme may change because facts on the ground change. You go through discovery. But when you're litigating certainly against an agency and the record is already baked in, you don't have to worry about things changing. The themes will generally carry forward the whole way through and hopefully into the judge's favorable opinion.
Totally. I want to shift gears a little and talk a little bit about your path to this work. Can you talk a little bit about your background and when you decided to become a lawyer, and more specifically an environmental lawyer? Not to pull the Lorax, but I'm Jared Nicely and I'm here for the trees.
Yeah, I actually had never read the Lorax growing up. Funny story, until I was in college and told people that I wanted to go to law school for environmental work. But I went to college to be an urban planner, and I didn't really have any conception that the law might be a viable path for me until I was a third year in a required class called Law, Land, and the Environment that was taught by an adjunct professor, a senior attorney at the Southern Environmental Law Center in Charlottesville, Kay Slaughter. And that class basically used Supreme Court case law and somewhat of a Socratic method to teach aspiring planners about the law and how it limits and our ability as planners to get things done, but it's also mutable and malleable and something that folks in the legal world can change. And that piqued my interest in law as a potential positive force for change. And then a couple of circumstances changed for me. I started doing more work in the actual realm of planning and saw that planners are not the philosopher kings of local government. And no matter how good of a plan you have, it can get shut down by elected officials or other political appointees that have no expertise at all in planning. And then the market crash in 2008 meant that basically no planning jobs were available because mm-hmm. planning jobs are highly dependent on the housing market and property tax revenue. And so I had already been thinking about law school at that time and decided to just go for it. And I went to law school thinking I wanted to do planning related work. But from the encouragement of some folks I talked to at UVA Law, I just dove into anything that seemed interesting in my 1L year and really ultimately found that environmental work more broadly was more interesting to me than just work that was focused on urban planning and those types of issues. And so that's what I started diving into everywhere, whether it was the journal work or clinics or summer internships, just seeing what was out there was the goal that I had through law school. And I ultimately ended up interning at NRDC my 2L summer. And at the time, I still thought I wanted to do policy work. Never mind that I didn't have a real scientific background, but I was afraid of litigation. I didn't have any attorneys in my family growing up. I didn't really know much about litigation other than watching on TV, and it didn't seem like something I would want to do. But I had the opportunity when I was at NRDC for a summer to work with two very senior attorneys at NRDC on a case that was actually before our judge, our then future judge, Judge Huvel. And I poured myself into that case. It was a remedy proceeding about what should be done about a violation of the Endangered Species Act with relation to this bait that was intended to kill prairie dogs, but could also kill other endangered species when the prairie dogs would die. And I just really enjoyed the deliberative process of working on litigation and responding to, on a very aggressive schedule, briefing from interveners and from the government. And I thought we just had the best argument and that we were definitely going to win. And then Judge Huvel had an argument and was amazed at how she just diced our arguments apart and not really relying on the government's arguments or anything else, but just she could see what the issue was and got right to the nub of it and got all of us to get together and figure out a remedy that we could all live with because there wasn't really a clear answer in the law. And once I saw that, both the joy that I got out of the process, but like the humbling nature of just being in before someone who was just so much better than I was at the time and that I wanted to aspire to be, I knew that was the world that I wanted to be in. And from there, it was just figuring out how to get into a permanent position where I was litigating environmental cases in federal courts.
Yeah, I just love that story. I also love the fact that you are open. A lot of people, I think, become lawyers because they see lawyers on TV and they're like, I want to do that. I want to get up. I want to perform. I want to be in front of the jury. And for others, right, you see what law is really like, and there are parts of it that are not like on TV, and that's a good thing. That may actually lead you to litigation, as opposed to for some lawyers, when they get into a courtroom, they say, I like the TV courtroom better than the real courtroom. One of the things you said was going before a judge and working to solve a problem with the judge, with the other side, and coming to something that everybody can agree with. And I think that's a forgotten part about litigation, that litigation is about two sides that disagree on something, and there is not just one way to get to an answer. There are lots of different ways that courts can handle that, and that's super powerful in thinking about what it means to be a litigator.
Absolutely. I think I love my in-court time, but I would say I spend more time in court-ordered or court-suggested mediation than I do in front of a judge presenting an argument or even at status conferences, because it is often the best way to resolve cases. And particularly in environmental cases, we're always ready, or enforcement cases in particular, you we are and should always be ready to take the case to trial. But there are many instances in which the time and the uncertainty of that process is the case in all civil litigation. It's not worth it if the other side is willing to make some concessions that will get relief now that has certain, that will have certain value to the community. And I agree that I think that is just as important as your ability to convince a judge on a point of law.
And something that you also said or hinted at was you did this great internship. The internship, sometimes internships tell you what you don't want to do. This one told you what you wanted to do. But then the next step was getting that permanent job. And I've heard, particularly from people on the podcast and just people I've met with in the public interest litigation world, that can be a slightly less clear, more difficult process going into private practice or going into government. So I'm hoping you could talk a little bit about both maybe how you ultimately found your permanent position, but also how others who are going to be going on that path might think about navigating those difficult waters.
Sure. I found my position in a way that I think was more traditional 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago and before in the nonprofit world. I clerked for 2 years and then applied for fellowships and ended up getting a fellowship back at NRDC. And when my fellowship time was up, I was lucky enough that there was a spot open and were able to convert me to a permanent staff attorney. And that is how a lot of attorneys, and particularly in environmental, bigger environmental organizations, end up getting on staff. But there's also a lot of lateral hiring. And I think since the time when I joined NRDC, there has been a lot more expanded opportunities for people to come in from different, with different experiences and different backgrounds, and even straight out of law school. But I think the key when I'm doing hiring, and I think this is universal across the board in the nonprofit environmental litigation space, we're looking for people who have a commitment to public interest. And that can be demonstrated in a bunch of ways. It doesn't mean you've never worked at a law firm. In fact, some of the most committed public interest folks I've ever met worked at law firms and did incredible things. But I think if you want to work in this world, having a commitment to the mission is an important part of the job. But it really is about the experience that you get early on out of law school, and in law school too, but particularly early on out of law school. And for me, when I'm looking at experience, it's not the volume, but it's the value of it. Mm. And that means making sure you're getting real experience that is building real litigation skills early on, and that you're getting that experience with people who are willing to mentor you. I think having a champion and finding someone that will be your champion is the best thing that you can do for yourself as a law student and as an early career lawyer, because they'll make sure that you're getting the experiences that you want, and that they will connect you with the people that can help you along in your career. And you know, it, particularly if you're someone who, like me, who had no connection to the law before going into law school, you really need someone that can help shepherd you through the process. The other thing I think about experience in particular is if you are looking to do litigation, getting some litigation experience early on is really important. There's a truism in litigation that if you litigate, that you can't start litigating 5 years into your career. You can litigate early and then switch to policy or switch to regulatory work, but you can't do the opposite. I don't know that's necessarily true, but I know that enough people think it's true that it's you see it playing out in practice. So if litigation is the path that folks want to take, focusing on your first opportunity of getting litigation experience, even if it's not environmental, even if it's not necessarily public interest, is probably just as valuable and potentially more valuable than getting environmental policy experience where you wouldn't be working on complaints or briefs or developing.
You say you want people who are dedicated to the mission. Mm-hmm. And my question is, how does somebody convey that in a cover letter or in a resume? Is it classes taken? Is it people met? Is it just statements about your view of the mission? Like, how can people sort of brass tacks convey that in a sort of cold piece of paper before they ever get in the room with you?
think we're back to the complaint discussion, right? It's you put down the facts that are best for you and you tie them together. And it's all of the above. In the end, it's there are you can demonstrate your interest based on just the fact that you've learned a lot. And you've never had the opportunity to put that learning into practice because for whatever reason, you had to take a different job or you didn't get the jobs you applied for. And I think you can tell that story. You can tell that story through, I'll anonymize this example a little bit, but I remember reviewing an application where someone had worked at a firm. This is many years ago now, but and had a realization in the middle of a case that like, this was not what they wanted to be doing. And it wasn't like a generic, like this too many hours. It was a, like, I can't be on this side of the fight on these types of issues anymore. And 2 months later was applying to work. Mm-hmm. And that can be a story that tells and it shows a commitment to making a shift. I don't think it's a particularly heavy burden to get in the door for an interview if you're otherwise qualified, if you're able to demonstrate the basic, like, why me, why now, why is this the time that I want to make this transition into this type of career?
I guess the other half of that was finding your champion. I love that. I'm going to use that word with my students now. Any thoughts on how to find a champion? You're, as you said, you didn't know a lot of lawyers. You didn't even know you wanted to be a lawyer until pretty late in your college career. What's the best way to at least set yourself up, whether you're a future law student, a law student, a junior lawyer, if you haven't yet found one of your champions, any thoughts on thinking about how you might make that happen?
I think it's prioritizing making personal connections with people that you work with, people or acquaintances with. In a legal internship setting, for instance, it's making sure you kind of reach out and try to affirmatively make a connection with people that goes beyond the paper trail of here's an assignment, here's my memo, thank you for the edits, I appreciate them, here's the final version. And in law school, it's going to office hours and actually kind of trying to make a connection that goes beyond just the professor-student relationship. But it's also talking to other people, especially your peers, or preferably peers that are a couple of years ahead of you, about who good champions are. The thing about champions, and I actually thought that I got that phrase from you.
I'll take the credit. It's fine.
The thing about good champions is it's very infrequent that they're a champion for one person. They are people who are dedicated to the training of early career attorneys and seeing it through. And so you can often find those people by talking to other, you know, folks that are closer in your age or stage of your career, and understanding who are the right people to know to have those connections and make sure that you have the support you need when it's time to make a transition to another field or another type of work.
Yeah. And in terms of something I don't think I realized as a law student, and now I'm on the professor side, so I get to hold office hours instead of go to office hours. And I was never an office hours person because I always thought, well, if I don't have a specific question from the book, then I shouldn't be going to office hours. And I have now learned on the other side, you don't need a question about the class to go to office hours. Go meet the person. Don't not have any agenda. Don't come in and expect the professor to ask you questions, but come in and say, I want to hear about your background. I want to hear about where some of your students have gone. Here are some of the things I've liked about law school. Any thoughts on people I should meet or any thoughts on internships I might try to get? Building those relationships. And I think this is even going to be harder as we move to more remote work and less phone calls and more emails of, as you said, that like task by task communication. Professor, you gave me this assignment. I finished the assignment. Thanks so much. Have a great day. Same thing with the internships. Mm-hmm. You have to think big and you have to take the lens out a little bit. I think in order to build those relationships in a way that I don't think was obvious to me 10 or 15 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think I was this is something that, you know, the advice I'm giving is not necessarily advice I personally took going through law school as well. And I'm seeing it from my perspective of reviewing a lot of applications every year for jobs. And then also I oversee the summer legal intern program for all of NRDC, which is 26 interns each summer, and try to cultivate a relationship where we're your supervisor is your default champion in creating an environment where that's easy to make those connections. And it's not until you're on this side, I think, that you see the potential for those relationships that often goes unrealized. And it's a two-way street too, but I think that it's definitely the one thing that I would do more of if I went back to law school is make sure I got to know my professors better and on a more personal level.
Absolutely. And the other thing I don't want to miss is this idea of finding people who are just a little bit ahead of you. They may not be the best champions because they don't have the same sort of experience or credentials, but they can be your Sherpa. It's so helpful to talk to somebody who has just gone through what you're about to go through because it is so fresh in their mind. And also, they just have really perfect just-in-time information. And sometimes that comes in the form of affinity groups where you find people who have similar interests. But I just don't want to leave that point because I think it's really important to find people who are just ahead of you because they can be far more helpful sometimes than super senior people who don't have the same perspective. So I do want to ask, if you're a junior lawyer, law student, thinking about going to law school and you're interested in doing environmental work, there are lots of jobs, I imagine, beyond just being a environmental law litigator at a nonprofit. What are some of the other ways that you can work in the environment space in theory to support the environment, but not exactly do your job?
Sure. I can give examples or archetypes that I see and work with every day in my job, but there are policy advocates where you do every type of kind of advocacy you can imagine on behalf of your client and ultimately the environment. So that may include some litigation, but it's not litigation focused. It'll also include advocacy before administrative agencies, advocacy to Congress, so lobbying, and to state legislatures as well. And those jobs tend to be a little more subject matter specific. So you would be focused on clean air issues or clean water issues or wildlife protection issues. And so your expertise is on the subject matter, and the tools that you're wielding on to further your interests are all the tools in the box of pulling levers of the government to try to protect the environment. There are also increasingly more attorneys that do work, kind of client-focused work with environmental justice communities that again, can be tangential to litigation, but can also relate to other types of advocacy. But the focus there is not necessarily on one specific type of environmental problem or silo of environmental work, but it focuses on the needs of the community at issue and identifying and marrying those needs with the tools that can best address them. And the type of work that you will get really varies by the type of organization, whether it's a big green organization where you have run the gamut of all the environmental issues you can work on and all the different levers of advocacy that you can pull, to smaller organizations that focus on one particular issue or one particular even region. But a lot of issues and the types of advocacy that you may do there really differ. I think the one thing that you can guarantee across all types of environmental work is it's going back to this translation issue. And it's really clarity of communication, being able to clearly communicate the problem, the solution, and how to get there is critical to the mission and to successful work. And along with that, there's a bit of an organizing component as well. That is identifying community needs, communicating clearly with the community about what the solution might be, getting their input, and then making sure that we're matching the ultimate requests that we're making, whether it be to legislatures, agencies, city councils, or the court, with what would actually make the best impact.
And in terms of communicating, you started your career before you were able to join the environmental fight full-time as a law clerk. And that's obviously where we met, but I'm hoping you could talk a little bit about what you learned about communicating to courts and to judges and to parties through your experience, both on the district court and on the Court of Appeals.
I learned more about writing in those 2 years than I had any time before and any time since. I like to joke that on the Court of Appeals, I learned how to write well. And then on the district court, I learned how to write well quickly. And it But it is, I think, the advice that sticks out from my first judge on the Fourth Circuit, Judge Motz, about writing, her basic advice is it's all about the ABCs. It's accuracy, brevity, and clarity. Mm. What you write has to be accurate. And that applies to anyone, but especially advocates, because credibility is our currency with the court. If you're not credible, you're not going to get anything. But once you have something accurate, you got to make it as brief as you can, because if you have to keep the judges or the public's attention to actually get the impact that you want. And as you're working to whittle down, you have to make sure that you're maintaining clarity as well. And those three, the ABCs of writing, have really stuck with me over time. And I always do a gut check on any piece of work that I'm doing, just to make sure that I feel like all three are adequately represented in the final product. But one of the best things about clerking, and why I will recommend it to anyone who's considering it, whether you want to litigate or not, but especially if you want to litigate, is you get a chance to work with people who are at the absolute top of their profession. And the amount that you work with them on a specific case is proportional to the difficulty of the case. Hmm. So you're not only getting to work with them closely for a year or 2 years, but you are getting to work most closely on the cases that are most difficult, that require the most creativity, that require the most critical thinking, and that in communicating to the public, to the parties, what the law is and what the outcome is, require the most attention. And there's something really just unparalleled about that, that you can't match elsewhere.
Yeah, I love that. I often joke that being a law clerk is giving you the opportunity to be a judge's brain for a year or two, even though obviously you just get to look at their brain. You don't actually get to serve as their brain. But I really think that point about the harder the case, the more closely you get to work is absolutely right. And also, look, there's not enough clerkships for everybody who wants them. And so find ways to work with the top people in your field. That could be an externship. That could be an internship. That could be finding an opportunity like a clerkship, not with a judge, but with someone in your field. Because I think you're absolutely right. If you can see that early on, it colors everything after the fact.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a related point about that in practice, once you're actually out there, that I think there's value early in your career to trying to get involved with really complex cases, if you can, that are cutting edge. It may be intimidating, but it's often going to be your opportunity to work with the best folks, whether it's at your firm or at the nonprofit organization you're working at or within the government, because those are the cases that are going to get the most attention for how do we square this circle? How do we make this argument work? And so there's a Hamiltonian, or I guess a Burian, I want to be in the room where it happens. And you can't replicate that after the fact.
Look, Jared, this has been so fantastic. I love to end all these interviews by asking for a piece of advice, something you wish you knew, or something you tell your interns that you work with every year, or new law students, something about being an environmental lawyer or just being a lawyer more broadly.
Everyone makes mistakes. Absolutely everyone. It's okay when you make a mistake. And the key is to identify it and to work to rectify it as soon as you can. Almost all mistakes are reversible, and ultimately in the grand course of litigation or whatever you're working in, meaningless. But if you don't work to address it, that's when trouble can arise.
Absolutely. All right, Jared. Well, I just want to say thank you. This has been fantastic, and keep fighting the good fight.
Thanks, Jonah. This is great.